So, Matthew chapter 8, starting in verse 5, Jesus heals the centurion's servant. And the parallel, paralleled in Luke chapter 7, starting in verse 1. And it's interesting to notice that Matthew and Luke record this event differently. Some people would think that they're in a contradiction to each other, but they're not in contradiction. They just tell the same story in different ways. So we'll see. Let's read the Matthew record, and then the Luke. This is Matthew chapter 8, starting in verse 5. When he had entered Capernaum, this is Jesus, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly." And he said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion replied, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you under my roof, but only say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly, truly, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you that many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And to the centurion Jesus said, "Go, let it be done for you as you have believed." And the servant was healed at that very moment. Now, Luke records it a little bit differently. Luke chapter 7, after he had finished saying all these things in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. So up to that point, it's just the same. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue." And Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you. But say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to this servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turning to the crowd that followed him, said, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. So in Matthew, Matthew records this with Jesus speaking to the centurion face to face. Luke records this, though, as the centurion sending people, first the elders of the Jews, to request Jesus come to his house and heal his servant. And then, before Jesus actually gets all the way to his house, another group of friends to tell him not to bother coming into his house. Oh, dear. I punched a button. There it is. So Matthew has Jesus speaking directly to the people, to the centurion, and Luke has Jesus not speaking directly to the centurion, but speaking to the people who are speaking on behalf of the centurion. Some would say this is a contradiction, but you don't have to see it that way. It's just two different ways of telling the same event. The elders of the Jews were acting at the request of and on the behalf of the centurion. So Matthew can rightly say that Jesus was speaking to the centurion. He wasn't speaking directly to him, but he was speaking to him through his representatives. So for some reason, who would know why, Matthew decides to record this in a more compressed fashion and to leave out the bit about the middlemen between Jesus and the centurion, and to record it as if Jesus were speaking directly to the centurion. And Luke has more detail and includes the part with the centurion sending delegates to speak with Jesus. So it's an interesting that they, it shows one thing, you can't imagine that they're copying from each other or that they're copying from a third source. They seem to have their own way of telling the story. Now the point of the miracle and the point of telling us this this event is not to establish who actually spoke to Jesus. Was it the centurion or his centurion's friends? It is the point is the what the centurion recognizes about Jesus and what the Jews hadn't quite come to realize. The centurion sees it before they do. So we start with the centurion, a Gentile commanding a company of Roman soldiers in Capernaum. A centurion was an officer in charge. They called him a centurion because he was in charge of 100 soldiers. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be exactly 100. It would be, you know, somewhere between 80 and 200. I don't know what the exact number. I'm sure they weren't, the stickler wasn't about exactly 100 men, but it was a company of that size. And apparently, if you were a centurion, you were in your post of duty for some period of time, long enough for this centurion to become friendly with the local people, and quite friendly with the local people. And I read in my Bible dictionary that this is a that he would be roughly equivalent to a junior officer. Terry, you can tell us. You were in the military. Mm-hmm. Is that like a captain?
What's that?
Yeah. Is that a junior officer? They have captains in the Air Force?
No, that would relate to today's ranks. I would think at least a captain.
Okay. Probably not a major. But he was... if he's non-commissioned, would that make him like a master sergeant, or what do they have?
Chief master.
Is that what they have in the Air Force?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Senior master.
And apparently, I'm presuming that this centurion is on good terms with his command, and they don't mind him, you know, settling into Capernaum and establishing roots and making friends, which is it's just kind of odd to hear that the commander of an occupying army would be on such friendly terms with the locals. But apparently, the local elders of the Jews really thought highly of this guy, and he thought highly of them, so much so as to build the synagogue. There are several centurions in the New Testament. There's this guy. There's Cornelius, is that his name? The centurion that Peter goes and talks to in Acts. And there's a couple of other centurions in the book of Acts. And to the best of my knowledge, in the New Testament, the centurions are always highly regarded. They are always friendly to the Christians, doing something nice for the Christians, you know, protecting their lives, like the centurion did with Paul. So they're always spoken well of in the New Testament. The centurion had a servant, some translations say a slave, who was sick and at the point of death, who is highly valued by him. And Luke records that the Matthew says the I think it was no that was Luke. Luke says the centurion was sick and at the point of death. Matthew says the servant was lying paralyzed, suffering terribly. Now, just to usually, I've noticed three times so far that Luke has more medical details than the other gospel writers when it comes to describing a person's sickness. But just to prove me wrong, he has fewer details this time. It's Matthew that has that the servant's paralyzed and suffering terribly. So there goes my theory, just to prove me wrong. And he was a servant or a slave, and he was quite concerned about his slave. Not all masters, it appears, are unconcerned. So we have to keep that in mind when we think about what slavery meant when we read about it in the Bible. And the Jewish elders came to Jesus. They pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for them." They really think highly of this centurion. He's worthy to have his servant healed, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue. Now, I looked it up again in my Bible dictionary or somewhere, and it seems that Capernaum was not a large city. They said 1,500 population. So that's twice New Deal and maybe half of Hidaloo, equal to about half of Hidaloo. No doubt everybody knew everybody in town because that's the way life goes in towns of this size. So you would think that Jesus, who had lived in Capernaum for some time, would know these Jewish elders. They would have been the synagogue leaders, and he spoke in the synagogue. So he's going to be familiar with these men. And the centurion has built us our synagogue. I don't know exactly what that means, if he financed the construction of the synagogue, or he provided materials, or he provided labor, or in some way, he has built their synagogue. And Jesus said, "I will come and heal him." And Jesus went with them to return back to the centurion's house. And before he could get back to the house, Luke records that the centurion had sent even more friends, telling him not to bother to come all the way to his house. He doesn't need to do that. Again, Matthew has this discussion as occurring directly between Jesus and the centurion, but Luke tells us more details. It was actually through the centurion's friends. "I'm not worthy," the centurion says, "to have you come under my roof." I don't know if the centurion had a sense of guilt for sin, or if it was he trying to be considerate, because he would know that typically Jews didn't go to the houses of Gentiles. I didn't write down, I thought about it, but I didn't write down the reference. But you remember that part of the reason Peter was called on the carpet for going and preaching to Cornelius was that he went to this Gentile's house and he was associating with Gentiles. They just didn't do it. The centurion just doesn't want to put Jesus in a position of having to deal with whatever problems people would complain about if he actually went to the centurion's house. But notice also this is Luke. He addresses Jesus as Lord. He says, "Lord, do not trouble yourself." So this at least was a sign of respect. And it has to be more than that, because he's asking Jesus to heal his servant. So he knows that Jesus is more than just the typical guy walking down the street. He knows that he is a healer. So he must consider him a holy man or a man of God of one way or another. And since he's building the local synagogue, you would I would presume that he is at least a God-fearer, one who accepts and believes in the God of Israel, even if he whether he's a proselyte to Judaism or not, he at least is a God-fearer. And the centurion says, "But say the word." The centurion understands Jesus doesn't have to be present to heal. Now, this is in contrast with the Israelite or the Jewish people of the time. We read last week that they were crowding around Jesus, trying to touch him. Not only did they think Jesus needed to be present, they think they need to actually physically touch him before they can be healed. The centurion knows more. He says, just say the word. You don't even have to be here, and you can heal the servant. Then he says, I'm a man under authority. I know what it is. The centurion, he recognizes someone who has authority. He's in the middle of a command structure. He has superior officers that he answers to. He has soldiers that answer to him. He knows what it is to give and take orders, and he sees that Jesus is one who can give and take orders. He recognizes that Jesus has that authority too, which is more than the Jewish contemporaries of Jesus had yet to recognize. Truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. Now, this wasn't the first time that Jesus had healed with a word without going to the person. We read before in John chapter 4 that was some kind of official from Capernaum was talking to Jesus when he was in Cana, I believe, a town some distance away. And Jesus told him that to go on his way, that the person would, his son, I think it was his son he was concerned about, would be healed. Now, so Jesus had, we have a record of him healing with a word without going to the person before. But this is the first time somebody asked Jesus to not bother coming. He could do it from a distance. That's a deeper understanding of who Jesus is compared to the Jews. And Jesus then says, "With no one in Israel have I found such faith." He says, "I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." I keep punching the button. His own did not receive him. We read in John chapter 1, the children of Abraham. While the sons of the kingdom will be the sons of the kingdom, those would be the Jews. They are rejecting Jesus, and it's others who are accepting him. In this case, it's the centurion. And there will be more, Jesus says, from east and west, reclining at the table, at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the kingdom of heaven. Now, it's another topic altogether. When we read of the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God, we immediately think heaven, you know, final resting place, heaven. I don't know if that's exactly what Jesus had in mind or not, but there is some sense that those in the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God, which is a synonymous in many places, will be reclining at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs. Then Jesus said to the centurions, "Go, let it be done for you as you have believed." So Jesus again heals with a word. And when they had returned back to the house, they found the servant well. Matthew says the servant was healed at that very moment. The one who was paralyzed in agony and at the point of death is now found to be well. So the meaning of the sign, I think it's what Jesus said about, with no one in Israel have I found such faith, and many from the east and west will recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The blessing of the kingdom of heaven comes to those who have faith, regardless of their nationality. It's not just for the children of Israel. It's for all people. And we know that because the servant was healed, that the servant of the Gentile was healed at that very moment. Okay. The next miracle is in Luke chapter 7, the next verse, starting in verse 11. This account is only in Luke. So this is something that is only recorded in one gospel. Luke chapter 7, starting in verse 11. Soon afterward, he went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a great crowd went with him. As he drew near to the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a considerable crowd from the town was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." Then he came up and touched the bier, and the bearers stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him to his mother. Fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people. And this report about him spread through the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country. So this is soon after the account we just read with the centurion and his servant. Soon afterward, it says, some translations say the next day. So it's a question of exactly how to understand the words. And it's also a little bit complicated because Nain was a good day's journey from Capernaum. The next day, walking into town, while a funeral procession is walking out of town, it's kind of hard to see how they would have time to walk that distance. But soon afterward, maybe a better understanding. So if it wasn't the next day, it was the day after that. Nain, a town about, again, a day's travel away from Capernaum. His disciples and a great crowd went with him. Jesus is attracting a crowd. But not only a crowd, they're dedicated enough to travel with him. So I don't know how many people are in a great crowd, but more than just the disciples, more than the 12 and other disciples that were also with him, a great crowd, it says. As he drew near to the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out. So Jesus is leading a procession one direction into town, and he meets, coming the other direction, I presume, a funeral procession, also a large crowd, it says, leaving the town, either happenstance, or if you don't believe in happenstance, by the providence of God, whichever you choose to believe, I suppose. I would hope you lean toward the providence of God. And the man, they were carrying a man from the town out to the tombs, no doubt. They didn't bury in the ground like we bury in the ground. They put people in tombs carved out of rock. I don't know if they lived in a flat place like this, what they would do. I guess, lucky for them, they didn't. I presume that the man had just recently died, had to be, probably not that day, but the day before, at the most, the day before that. They didn't have much time to... They didn't have embalming and they didn't have refrigeration, so they had to act quickly. And it's first reported as a man who had died. Jesus addresses him as young man in the next couple of verses. He's not a child, and he's not an old man. He's addressed as a young man. So I'm reading this as someone of marriageable age, 20-ish or so, apparently unmarried. He's the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. Now, I don't remember the Bible recording any rich widows. I think they are always poor, and perhaps widow and poor are synonymous, more or less. And now she's lost her only son, who would have been her last means of support. I presume that if her son is living, that he would marry, and she would live with him and his family. And it's not like she's freeloading. She would do what people do. She would tend the garden and look after the kids and prepare food and maintain the clothes and, you know, the stuff that people have to do to live. And she would contribute to his family, and she would live in that manner. But now that he's dead, where's she going to go? When the Lord saw her, again, I don't know if Jesus, seeing the funeral procession, put two and two together and recognized the situation, or if he had any conversation with people about this, but one way or another, Jesus understands her situation. And when he saw her, he had compassion on her. So Jesus, recognizing her circumstances, has compassion on the widow. And this miracle seems to be motivated entirely by his compassion for this widow. And it looks like he's not doing an act of kindness for the dead man. He's doing an act of kindness for the dead man's mother by raising the young man back to life. Then he came up and touched the bier, is what it says in the English Standard Version, B-I-E-R, which is a word that we don't usually use. If you go to a funeral these days, they have coffins. We put the recently deceased in boxes. Sometimes they open the box, sometimes they don't. But in those days, they were carried not in a closed box, but on a bier, which is just a platform, what do you want to call it? Planks? I don't know. But they were, I'm sure they were covered with cloth. Maybe their face probably covered as well. But they weren't closed in a box. They were lying on top of this bier being carried along. And Jesus came up and touched the bier, which would normally, he would now be ceremonially unclean, which is something the Jews would try to avoid, but Jesus doesn't seem to have any concern with this, with ceremonial cleanness. The bearers stood still, so I'm presuming there's at least four men carrying this funeral bier, which made me think when I was reading this, I have reached the stage in my life where I probably won't be called on for pallbearer duty anymore. You turn about 20 and you have grandparents and aunts and uncles, and you get called on for pallbearer duty pretty routinely, but I've probably reached the age of my life. I'm about out of aunts and uncles, so there you go. I've passed that stage. So they stood still. I guess he gives them the hold-up sign, and they do, not knowing what's going to happen. And Jesus said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." So this is the first report in the gospel we have of Jesus raising a person from the dead. We've got three reports in the Gospels, unless I'm forgetting one. There's this, the son of the widow of Nain. This is one. There's a daughter of a man named Jairus that we'll talk about later. And then there's Lazarus. Those are the only three reports we have of Jesus raising someone from the dead. In each of these three cases, he addresses the dead person directly. He says, young man, I say to you, arise. To the daughter of Jairus, he says, little girl, I say to you, arise. And for Lazarus, he says, Lazarus, come out. Lazarus was in the tomb at the time. So he addresses the dead person directly, telling them to arise. In Acts, Peter raises Dorcas from the dead, or Tabitha, as she's otherwise known, and he addresses her as well and says, Tabitha, arise. In Acts it says that Peter prayed before he said, Tabitha, arise, but Jesus doesn't pray to God to raise them. He tells them directly to arise. I don't know what we're to make of that, but it seems to be consistent. Now there's three times Jesus raises someone from the dead. There's once Peter does, and then once Paul does, the young fellow Tychicus, I say he's young, who fell asleep and fell out the window, they took him up as dead. Paul says, don't be alarmed, for his life is in him, and brought him back to life. So it doesn't record him saying anything to Tychicus, although it doesn't mean he didn't say something to Tychicus, but he was addressing the people that were watching. So I don't know that we can make anything of that. That's just that just seems to be the case. So, young man, I say to you, arise. And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him to his mother. So again, this was an act of kindness, not to the dead man, but to the dead man's mother. Fear seized them all, and they glorified God, which seems to be the appropriate response. A great prophet has arisen among us. I'm presuming they are thinking, they're watching what Jesus did, and they're thinking this is very much like what Elisha did. They would know their Sunday school lesson. Did they have Sunday school in those days? I don't know. But they would have heard of the prophet Elisha. In 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 32, starting in verse 32, you have to read about a chapter and a half to lead up to this point. Elisha has befriended a couple, a childless couple. Well, they have befriended him, and they set up a guest room for Elisha to stay in. And they were childless, and then they had a son. And then this son was out with his father working in the field, and he said, oh, my head, something like this. And they took the boy home, and he was dead by the end, by supper time. Then this is Elisha finally comes to the house. When Elisha came into the house, he saw the child lying dead on his bed. So he went in and shut the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. Well, in this case, Elisha prayed to God for whatever would happen, I suppose. Then he went up and lay on the child, putting his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, and his hands on his hands, and he stretched himself upon him. The flesh of the child became warm. Then he got up again and walked once back and forth in the house. This was Elisha, got up again and walked back and forth once in the house, and went and stretched himself upon him. The child sneezed seven times, and the child opened his eyes. And then he summoned Gehazi, which is Elisha's servant, and said, call the Shunammite, who was the mother of the child. So he called her, and when she came to him, he said, pick up your son. She came and fell at his feet, bowing to the ground. Then she picked up her son and went out. So Elisha had raised to life the child of the Shunammite woman, who otherwise I don't think has a name. And she's called a Shunammite from the town that she comes from. It turns out there are several parallels between Elisha and Jesus. They both raise this a child from the dead and present the child to the mother. Elisha, at one point, has someone producing oil out of oil and flour to bake food from. And Jesus produces food, feeding the 5,000. And there's a couple of other parallels as well. Just like there's parallels, well, it's stated more than just parallels, between John the Baptist and Elijah, there are parallels with Jesus and Elisha. And this report about him spread through the whole country of Judea and all the surrounding country. His fame was spreading. The meaning of the sign, I think the meaning of the sign was that given by the crowd. Jesus is a great prophet, and he has brought salvation to God's people. God has visited us, they say.